You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to episode 33 of the City of Man podcast. A special day for us as Coyle and I record on our just about our 1 year anniversary. So happy birthday to you, Coyle.
Yeah, happy birthday to you, Ed. But we're not going to sing.
But in any case, we are, in fact, celebrating our 1 year anniversary. Coyle and I released our first episode on the 11th of April in 2016. And now, some 33 episodes later, we've been around for a year. Are you surprised that we lasted a year? Either you and I didn't give up, or that the humanists didn't just kick us off of the network.
I'm surprised we didn't, you know, get up one day and all our passwords had been changed, and the City of Man just had disappeared from the internet.
Yeah,
it may be coming. Like that may be somewhere down the road.
We have covered a number of topics. Our first episode was entitled "What Is Politics," where we basically sort of introduced ourselves and our idea for the program, and we took a look at conservative political ideology, liberal political ideology. We talked a little bit about the idea of justice in the Bible, issues of church and state. Then we were sort of walking through the conventions this summer. Had a number of interesting interviews with Thabiti Anyabwile, Nick Rodriguez, and Rebecca Heinrichs. And worked our way through the beginning of the Trump presidency.
We've talked a lot of Trump this year, haven't we?
We have more than I think we'll need to do for the rest of our lifetimes. Though it's probably the case that we're going to at least have to return to the topic at least a little bit over the next 4 years. We've also sort of spun out a kind of a, what would you call it?
Sub-series
in the ancient asides that you're doing with Jordan.
It'll probably end up being in a much more of a regular-ish thing. At least Jordan and I have been chatting about that a little bit. But yeah, so that's we'll see where that goes. There are more of those episodes coming.
Yeah, and there are already a few in the can for those devotees of ancient politics. And do you have any thoughts or reflections on the last year of podcasting?
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly enjoyed it. I've enjoyed having, you know, a thoughtful liberal Christian to talk to. To work through with a lot of the stuff.
Oh, who's that? Who'd you meet?
Oh, yeah,
you meet somebody in your department?
I'm telling you this. He's out there, yeah.
Oh, okay.
So that's been actually kind of refreshing. I'd say so that's sort of on the positive side. I've certainly enjoyed the conversations and the substance and so on. On the negative side, I wish our schedules lined up better and we could do this more regularly. The mothership, the Christian Humanists, they do this, once a week? I don't think either of us have the time to do that. Which is unfortunate because I think it would be fun and would involve, you know, deeper conversations and so on. But
their ability to keep that schedule is dumbfounding to me.
Yeah. How about you, Ed? What have you thought about the last year?
And did you podcast at all before this show?
Never once.
Yeah. So the whole experience was brand new for me. I don't know if we've ever told the story about how the show was even launched. Do you want to tell that story?
If I can remember it, because it's been a while ago. My wife and I met the Christian Humanists through social media, because, you know, that's how everyone meets these days.
And you were listeners.
Had engaged a little bit on social media. I think I'd sent an email or two here and there. And then the Grubbses passed through the town we live in. We got to meet David and Katie Grubbs in person one time. Mm-hmm. And then my wife got to appear on, I want to say, the Christian Feminist podcast first, and then the Christian Humanist podcast, or maybe it was the other way around. I don't remember off the top of my head. And then sort of shortly after they saw that my wife was really awesome and that, you know, they wanted to have her around more, then I got the invitation too. So I think we can probably thank my wife for that. They basically asked me to find someone who was sort of me but more intelligent and liberal and a marathoner, and you know, there was only one of those around. So had basically asked me to look at putting together a podcast with someone of the opposite political persuasion. So
a politics podcast
from a Christian perspective, but between a conservative and a liberal, which I will tell you, and I'm sure you know this better than I do, that was a real challenge. Finding someone who is theologically orthodox, politically liberal, and philosophically informed, right? That those three things, any two of those, yeah, there's lots of those, but all three of them, man, that was tough.
I think so. I was literally the only person
you're actually the first person I found who met all three of the criteria, and you said yes. So thank you. I appreciate that. Saved me a lot of work, I think. And I forget, I'd sent an email to a group called Christians in Political Science, and one of them emailed me back your name, and I don't remember who it was now.
Yeah, it was Brian McGraw, is a political theorist at Wheaton College, and who's a friend.
I mean, that's basically the story.
Yeah,
we met, we emailed, we chatted a few times in person, and then we kind of jumped in. I mean, we didn't really know each other all that well.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting, and I have to say your email struck me just at the right time in which I was more open to doing things that I had never done like this before. Sorry, and so I'm stalling on the original question that you asked me. And so all of this to say that, like, the experience has been really good for me, and I've learned a lot. I've learned a lot about a lot. I've really learned a lot from you, Coyle, about small things, but then especially in just sort of understanding how you, as a conservative, sort of think through issues, and that's been really valuable.
Yeah, I feel the same way. It is because of the nature of where I teach, and largely where I've gone to school. Certainly there were liberals there, but again, in terms of really thinking in depth through the issues, by and large, they tended to be conservative institutions. So, like I said, I've learned a lot as well. I will say, I wish I'd known at the time when I sent that original email that you were at this sort of vulnerable place, and I would have asked you for money. I mean,
yeah. if you had been trying to solicit money, or if you were starting some kind of religious cult. And we're looking for devotees. Yeah, I probably would have been
I'm
up for a lot of
prince,
different kinds.
And if only you give me your bank account number.
Yeah, yeah. There's all this money in Nigeria that you.
Hey, you got to be in it to win it, Ed.
That's right. Play to win. In any case, we thought it would be interesting to celebrate our 1 year anniversary by soliciting questions from you, our viewers, and to do a kind of an Ask Me Anything episode or an Ask Us Anything episode. And in general, I have to say, just really, really grateful for all of our listeners, people who download and listen to the podcast, people who interact with us on Facebook or email us questions. I mean, questions for this particular episode or just the questions that we periodically get. There is a little bit of this weird feeling of, like, Coyle and I sit down and record these episodes and upload them onto the server and redo the XML code, and then they just sort of go out into the internets. And you sort of wonder, like, you know, you sort of wonder what happens to them. And so whenever we get any kind of interaction, so it's always, like, really, really gratifying and exciting. And, you know, as we've been really pleased with how the show has grown, and so we're really grateful. We're really grateful to all our listeners.
I should throw in that I am grateful to all of the work Ed does, because basically Ed does all of the electronic heavy lifting. He just said something about an XML code. I don't know what that is. Ed does that. Ed edits the shows. He puts them up on iTunes and Stitcher and wherever else they are. I don't even know where they are. I mean, iTunes is where I get it from. So thank you, Ed, for all of your hard work there.
Well, pleasure. I appreciate that. And I kind of find it fun and interesting. And then props to Nathan Gilmore, I guess, sort of gave me my little tutorial. That's been kind of fun, actually, doing that
backside
stuff.
Well, it doesn't sound like fun. So I appreciate it.
In any case, again, we wanted to build our anniversary episode around questions from you all. So we solicited lots of questions. In fact, there was a kind of a challenge. I will say that we got under 25 questions. And so what does that mean? Does that mean that you are wrestling a bear naked, or am I doing something with raccoons or something like that?
You were the bear and I was the raccoons. I don't remember who was naked. So
no, I'm pretty sure that... is that right? Am I the bear?
Unfortunately,
I have to wrestle a bear.
One of the downsides of our recording schedule is we record in advance and then things post, you know, weeks or months after we've recorded.
Yeah.
So.
In fact, this anniversary episode was recorded about 50 weeks ago in anticipation that... So congratulations to President Clinton. And anyways, we're very grateful to get all these questions, and so we should probably stop yapping and get into them. So, first of all, we get a question from Brandon Gerbracht, who asks, how do you approach the news? You reference things you read regularly. As the general public, I believe I'm in a position of not knowing anything at all because of the motives behind news sources. How do you sort through the biases and piece together a hypothesis of what is really going on? Coyle Neal, what do you read on a regular basis?
Yeah, so I think there's sort of two sides of that. As the general public, I think you can trust the news. You know, when you flip on whatever it is, be it, you know, Fox News or CNN or MSNBC or whatever, obviously they're all going to have their biases, and I think it is wise to mix them up. So watch Fox News one day and MSNBC the next, or, you know, one week and then the other one the next, or whatever. But I think what you'll find is that as they're covering stories, they're all presenting you with the same basic details. That may be untrue in any specific circumstance, but overall, the gist of it is still going to be there. You just have to realize that you're listening to human beings who are biased. So that's sort of one side of your question. You can watch the news and have a good idea for what's going on in the world. That's fine. In terms of what I follow specifically, I try to follow mostly conservative sources, being a conservative, but I also try to make sure that there are liberal things thrown in as well. So I read National Review fairly regularly. I try to keep up with Vox. I used to follow Slate and Salon. They've gotten a little clickbaity in the last few years, so I don't pay as much attention to them. The American Conservative, the Imaginative Conservative would be the big ones. None of those, by the way, are really news sources, right? Those are all positions mm-hmm. and policy opinion. And so on. I also use a service called Flipboard. It's sort of an aggregator. You tell it what topics you want, and it gathers stories from all over the web and puts them into one place and sort of filters through them.
Ah, but you give it a topic.
Yeah.
And
so
it...
that way I've got I've got like 10 things.
So I could enter in man bear wrestling and I would get all these articles.
I forget what all I follow on that. There's a couple of historical topics I'm interested in. I think Congress is something that I've got because it's kind of hard to find news about Congress. Maybe not so much these days, mm-hmm. but in general, usually the focus is on the president. So I've got Congress thrown up there. So anytime a story pops up somewhere about Congress, I listen to that. But I think the big way to figure out what's really going on is to keep a diversity of sources. Don't get your news from just one place, and that does include social media. Right. So if you're only on Facebook or if you're only on Twitter, make sure that you are doing other things too. And I would even go one step farther. This is advice. I want to say it comes from Russell Moore, but don't quote me too much on that. I might be mixing it up. Get a subscription to like an actual newspaper, like a physical hold in your hands newspaper. Mm-hmm. Ideally, a local mm-hmm. one, a state one or even a national one is fine too. That will also give you a good sense for what's going on because newspapers, unlike the internet, have to make decisions about what to print. There's an extra level of filtering there that has to go on. And, of course, everything that you read is going to be a little bit out of date, but they print knowing that, so they try to only print the really important stuff. Ed, what do you do for news consumption?
Yeah, I can't remember if I have talked about this, if I've on the show... Or maybe we were talking about this in class once. But, like, I really do think that not everybody can know everything about everything.
Sure.
I mean, we all have jobs and kids. But, like, insofar as something is really important, it probably behooves you to know something about it. And insofar as you feel really strongly about something, then it behooves you to know something about it. And I always tell my students, like, there should be a direct linear relationship between the volume with which you announce your views on something and how much you know about the opposing side of the view in question, right? And so, like, you have to earn the right to speak loudly on topics, and you earn it by the depth of your understanding of the other opposing view, and in some ways, it's really easy to sort of like to think you satisfied that demand by sort of reading one thing and then sort of quickly formulating like some reason why like that's a bad view, but like to really take the time to find the best argument in favor of the view that you oppose. People are smart. It's almost always going to be the case that like the opposing view, it should trouble you. Like if you're not troubled at how good the opposing argument is, if you're not a little bit sort of worried, then you probably haven't worked hard enough. And so, I mean, this is just reiterating your point. And so, I think the key to it all is, like, diversity of sources. And, I mean, I agree with you. There certainly is a kind of bias with regard to every news source. In a lot of ways, though, I think the bias has more to do with the kinds of topics that are chosen, as opposed to just, like, I mean, just outright falsifying information or slanting views as they're presented. And I think there's a way in which any mainstream media outlet, whether, you know, and here I include things like Fox News or CNN or like any of the big cable channels, they represent a diversity of political views, but they don't necessarily represent like the widest spectrum of political views. So like genuine political leftism doesn't really get represented in any of the mainstream news sources. And so, like, if you want that, you need to go to places like Democracy Now! And things like that.
Well, could we say they certainly don't hit everyone, but they hit the bulk of Americans. I mean, if you watch Fox, CNN, and MSNBC on rotation, you're gonna be sort of understanding what 90% of Americans think.
Yeah. But, you know, so most people sort of associate the news bias argument with conservatives. But, like, it's equally made by progressives who sort of look at that whole media complex, whether we're talking about, I mean, certainly if we're talking about Fox, but even if including, you know, even including CNN and CNBC, they sort of see them all as, like, okay, so CNBC is to the left of CNN, but there's still a way in which it kind of takes for granted a particular kinds of assumptions about...
I forget the exact number, but it's like a... something like five companies own 85% of all radio TV stations in the country. And if you count, you know, the federal government as a company and include, you know, PBS and NPR, that number jumps up to like 95%. I mean, it's six companies and, you know, 95%.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
I mean, obviously, no, that said, it's not like the corporate heads are deciding what the Daily News is going to be. So, you know, there is a factor there. I don't know that it actually affects what's shown on the screen at 5 o'clock when people are watching.
I mean, if that does happen, that certainly only happens on the margins. But like in some ways, that's not the only way to exert power, right? But in any case, I mean, I was just going to say that in terms of the stuff that I regularly, I actually almost never watch television, and I mean, part of that is personal habit. But like, whenever I watch any of that stuff. And again, whether we're talking about CNBC or CNN, like or Fox, I kind of think it's all universally awful because it's so superficial.
Well, that's the 24-hour news cycle, right? I mean, it sort of has to be.
Yeah.
I should point out, I don't really watch TV either, despite just defending all of them.
Uh-huh.
We don't have cable at home, and broadcast is kind of spotty where we live. And...
Yeah. I mean, I will say that I remember when I was a kid, my parents would flip on what was then McNeil Lehrer News Hour on PBS. And I don't know if you've ever watched that show. It's almost like they had a set designer whose brief was design the most boring and ugly set you could possibly design. And I remember every time I would hear that music go on, I'd be like, I can't believe, like, this is literally the most boring news show. And then as I got older, I have to say, like, the level, so I don't know if the extent to which you would say that PBS as a news source is biased in the liberal direction.
It's certainly biased in the liberal direction.
I wouldn't dispute that, at least with regard to the kinds of stories that they choose to cover. But their level of reporting, it's like there is nothing like it. I mean, you know, so when the Supreme Court is in session, they'll do 20 minutes of really hardcore, in some ways boring, but just extraordinarily informative reporting. As it is, I haven't watched NewsHour in a long time. So almost all my news I get in print or on the internet.
So what do you read?
The one magazine. So the one magazine that I read every week is The New Yorker. We have a New Yorker subscription. And again, I mean, so The New Yorker certainly has a kind of a liberal slant, especially with regard to the kinds of stories that they're interested in reporting. But again, like, the level of reporting that you get in The New Yorker is ridiculous. And so you get these, you know, when John Lee Anderson is off in the Near East somewhere, sitting down and doing interviews with, like, ISIS leaders. I mean, those stories are just, they're riveting and they're really interesting. And for me, it's also just sort of a one-stop shop, because you can get politics and culture and science and the cartoons, yeah, of course. And so, you know, and then I'll read the conservative sites that you mentioned, so the American Conservative and National Review. I kind of love David French because he has a really amazing way of putting his finger on what exactly the issue or point is. But then he also drives me crazy because he always draws the wrong conclusion. But I love him because it's sort of like, yeah, that's exactly right. Now, how can you possibly think that? But and I think he has integrity. And I read Rod Dreher's blog pretty regularly, and I'll kind of float around Vox and Slate occasionally. But I guess the big point again is just diversity and the extent to which you really care about something. It's like you got to know the other side.
Well, we shouldn't spend that much time on every question, but I don't think we'll have to.
Yeah,
because
no,
our next one.
Because some of these we're gonna be like, I don't know.
So, the next question is from Josh Nisley, who says that we briefly mentioned the Amish in several of our discussions, but only as examples of separatism and political disengagement. Mm. Since withdrawal from the cultural mainstream is such a hotly debated topic these days, thanks to Dreher's Benedict option, I'm wondering if you could talk more about the Amish, Mennonites, and other Christian groups who draw clear and non-overlapping lines between the kingdom of God and kingdoms of the world. Separation never a legitimate form of Christian witness? Does a healthy polis have room for those who choose not to participate, or are the Amish parasites for not voting? More generally, how much have either of you engaged with Anabaptist political thought, the vein of John Howard Yoder's Politics of Jesus or Howard Wass's Resident Aliens? How, if at all, has it shaped your thinking? That's way more than one question. Congratulations on a great first year, and so on and so on. Ed, let's start with that first part. Talk to us about the Amish, the Mennonites, and other Christian groups.
Yeah, so we have alluded to them in passing a little bit. I would say that I've read a good bit of Howard Wass in particular. I mean, Howard Wass is one of the most important moral theologians living today. He came to UVA to speak a few times when I was a grad student there. I know John Howard Yoder's book, The Politics of Jesus. For what it's worth, I think when Samir Yadav and I interviewed Nick Woltersdorf on his political theory and political theology, we touched on some of these issues a little bit. I mean, so I would say that I'm not an Anabaptist. I certainly wouldn't say, though, that they're parasites on society. I myself aren't persuaded by the theological or ethical arguments and the criticisms of the coercive power of the state as being tantamount to violence. But, I mean, one thing, well, a couple things at least. Like, one thing, like, I do think that those kinds of arguments represent really, really important correctives in in a kind of a cultural environment that valorizes violence, and with regard to a church in the United States that is all too easily sort of co-opted by the current spirits of the age. I remember I was reading Richard Hayes's The Moral Vision of the New Testament, which is a great book in moral theology. I probably referenced it before. And Hayes is a pacifist. And I remember reading his chapter on the use of force, which was a really, really compelling chapter in a lot of ways. And I wasn't ultimately convinced of his pacifism, but it did sort of convict me in a really personal way with regard to sort of like the amount of violence that I tolerate in my own life. Whether I'm sitting behind the wheel in traffic and yelling at some driver who is doing something stupid, or watching football in some ways, or certainly the kinds of movies that I watch. That was a way in which it was an important personal kind of corrective. And then I would say that I do think that that kind of Anabaptist vision of withdrawal is an incorrect picture of Christian engagement. But sort of the real emphasis, like Harold Wass is always talking about how the church should be the church, and the church setting up a kind of an alternative social reality against the world. Like, I do think that stuff is really, really important. How about you, Coy?
Just to answer Josh's questions, yes, yes, no, no. All right, let's move on. Yes, just to hit them. I have not read Yoder or Howard Wass, so I won't speak to them specifically. I have read some Anabaptist political thought. The one that I've read and enjoyed most, unfortunately, is out of print now. It's by a guy named Arthur Gish, and it's called it's like New Left and Christian Radicalism or something along those lines. He was one of the movers and the shakers in Students for a Democratic Society back in the '60s, up there with Todd Gitlin and some of those folks. Is a devout Christian, was a devout Christian, he's passed away now, who writes basically about what politics should look like from kind of a radical Anabaptist point of view. And it's interesting stuff. It's worth getting a copy of if you can find one. In terms of, is separation ever a legitimate form of Christian witness? I think the answer is yes, but heavily conditioned yes. General, the default setting for a Christian should be witnessing among the world, witnessing within the world, not witnessing by leaving the world. Now, obviously, there are times when all of us as Christians have to separate, right? I mean, there are activities that society engages in that we're not allowed to engage in. That's maybe not as pronounced in modern America as it was in, say, ancient Rome. We don't all have to go down and sacrifice to the idols. But I'm sure there are equivalents of that, in which case we would say, you know what, that's a place where Christians need to separate. And of course, to some extent, and this will come up a little bit later in our Q&A, every Sunday when the church gathers, we are separating from the world. I mean, that is a point where we are declaring sort of publicly, this is for us, this is a time for Christians to gather together and worship, and the rest of the world is not welcome here, not in the sense that we don't want non-believers there to hear the gospel, but in the sense that we're not doing it for them. We are doing it with each other. Does a healthy polis have room for those who choose not to participate? It should. You should always give people the option, in normal circumstances, of withdrawing from some things that society does. Now, I think there are things that you can't do that with, but in general, yeah, and that follows on with are the Amish parasites for not voting? I don't think so. This question comes up. So I live right now. I live in a community with a lot of Amish people, and that comes up a lot with the question of vaccination. Should the Amish get vaccinated? Well, some of them do, some of them don't. Of course, it depends on which colony. Similar questions where I grew up. I grew up just down the road from a Hutterite colony, and you had sort of all of the things that all of the same questions came up there. And I think the answer is no. They're not parasites for not voting, but they're also not completely withdrawn from society, right? I mean, it's not like there is no contact with them or no engagement at all. But I've exhausted everything I know about the Amish, so I'll be happy to leave that there.
Yeah, I think Josh is right, though. I mean, we should maybe dedicate an episode sort of talking about Anabaptist political sure. theology. But for now, we turn to a trio of questions, all having to do with constitutional interpretation. So, Carter Stepper writes, lots of questions. Well, there's one bit of a question here about Hannah Arendt that Carter asks, and I'll just go ahead and say, yeah, Coyle and I aren't going to be able to say a lot about Hannah Arendt. So I will skip to the main part of the question. So Carter writes, what do you think about the Marbury versus Madison decision? Do you believe the court does have the jurisdiction to interpret the Constitution? Similarly, Miguel Benitez writes, my question for you is, what was the role of the Supreme Court prior to Marbury versus Madison? It seems to me our entire understanding of the court is influenced by the idea of judicial review. I've not heard any clear explanations of what it was like prior to that decision. And then in a similar vein, Neil Gussman writes in, and he asks for Coyle. If I understand you correctly, in the most recent episode on the Constitution, you could make the case for segregation. So my question is, could you say on what basis segregation would be constitutional? So we have a little more general questions there, and then that narrower question. Coyle, do you want to sort of put your constitutional law hat on and talk a little bit about the Marbury versus Madison decision?
Yeah, so Marbury versus Madison, it's a tough case. It's if you've ever tried to read it, it's actually fairly long, too. But basically, the question is: Did the Supreme Court have the right to decide Marbury versus Madison in the way that it decided? And the answer is sort of a mixed yes and no. So at issue, of course, is the question of what do you do with in that case an executive action that seems to contradict the Constitution, and then the broader question is what do you do with a law that gets passed that contradicts the Constitution? So if Congress passes this law. And it you know takes away freedom of speech from someone, and of course the Constitution protects freedom of speech. Which of those wins? You know the congressional statute or the Constitution? Marbury versus Madison says the Constitution has to win, which is fine. I don't know that very many people would disagree with that. Even back then, I don't know how many people would have disagreed with that. But then the court goes on and.
Well, like, what's the point of having a constitution if it's not going to do anything?
I mean, you could argue that the Constitution empowers Congress in certain ways, and some of the ways it empowers it might allow it more latitude than others would say. But the controversial part, of course, is not the Constitution wins. The controversial part is, and we, the Supreme Court, are the arbiters of that. That's where I think you're on much mm-hmm. shakier constitutional grounds. I would be much more comfortable if we were just to pass an amendment saying the Supreme Court has the power of constitutional review, of judicial review. I think that would straighten a lot of stuff out. With that said, we have an English common law system, so they are sort of the authority. These things do end up in the courts. And it raises the question of who would the alternative be if Congress passes a law and the president signs a law that's unconstitutional, that's in violation of the Constitution. I suppose the only other answer would be it's the job of the states, right? So that's one of the ways we get ideas like nullification and interposition, the idea that states should have the power to veto a federal law. Again, that's also not constitutional, so that power is also not there. So... you're right that Carter and Miguel are right that this is a problematic issue, but at this point we've also been doing it for 250 years. So the tradition, the precedent is well established. It's unlikely to disappear anytime soon.
Great. And do you want to say something about segregation?
Yeah, I could make the case for segregation. I mean, I certainly can't make a moral case for it. I guess in terms of making a constitutional case, it would depend on how you read the 14th Amendment. So I would say that a good originalist reading of the 14th Amendment would be to say that segregation is unconstitutional. And the point that I, if I remember right, the point I was trying to make in the constitutional interpretation episode was that there is a way to do that. I wish Brown versus Board of Education had done that. Instead, what they said is basically, we think this is good policy, and it's what we want the Constitution to say, so we're declaring it. And that's sort of my hang-up there. I don't know if that answers his question or not. On what basis is segregation mm-hmm. constitutional? I guess it would have to be states get to decide how they're going to treat their own citizens as citizens of states. And if they want to divide them up by race or by class or by religion or by gender or whatever, then that's within their prerogative to do so. Again, it all sort of hangs on that equal protection clause in the 14th Amendment.
Neil Gussman also added, he wonders when the idea of heresy disappeared from the evangelical church.
Yeah, when I was born, Neil. I mean, there's probably some blasphemy in that particular statement. I don't know that heresy has disappeared from the evangelical church. Part of that is it depends on what you mean by evangelical church. And Sectarian Review is going to be doing an episode on that down the road. So stay tuned. We'll hit that topic later. He also said when he became a Christian in the 70s, the pastor of the Baptist church he attended gave him a King James Version of the Bible and a copy of Kingdom of the Cults.
Yeah, do you know that
fine.
Book?
Kingdom of the Cults is a good book, unless you meant the Bible, in which case it's also a good book.
KJV yeah. Bible. Tell me about that.
What do you think about the King James, Ed?
The language is some of the most beautiful language in the English language.
Adam Nicholson has a book on the history of the King James Bible, and it's fantastic. It's mm-hmm. totally worth reading.
Is it?
But one of the points he makes is that the
I don't use the KJV on a regular basis, but like if I'm in class and there's a passage of scripture that I want to read, I'll sometimes check and see what the KJV translation is and rely on it.
Well, yeah, and that's Nicholson's point is it's basically the English version of the Gothic cathedral. It's their linguistic mm-hmm. version of that, and I think that's exactly right. The language is elevated. The rhetoric forces your eyes and your heart upward, and it's great as far as that goes. Now, I would never mm-hmm. give it to a new Christian. As far as that goes, the ESV, the NIV, the NASB, I mean, any of those are going to be better bets just because they're so much more readable, certainly in the modern age.
You didn't say the NRSV. How do you feel about the NRSV? Wasn't sure if you were resisting its gender-neutral language.
So the NIV has gone gender-inclusive, not quite gender-neutral, in the past few years.
Sorry, yeah, I guess
so
that...
So I guess I should say the 1984 NIV. The new one, I understand why they did it. I have a problem with calling that a translation. If the word in Hebrew is man, then the word in English should be man. If they mean person... I understand when they are using man to refer to all mankind, all of humanity, why you want to make that word person. Mm-hmm. But again, that raises questions of translation.
I could push back on that, but we'll save that for another episode. What's your go-to Bible?
I actually still like the 1984 NIV. In church, we use the ESV, and I in my own devotions, I guess I'm increasingly using the ESV. As I'm teaching my 2-year-old memory verses, I'm actually using the King James. So, with the thought that hopefully it'll make NIV easier once he's older and memorization is harder. While he's 2 and he's a little sponge who just remembers absolutely everything you say, even the stuff you don't want him to. I'm going with the stuff that's a little harder. Well, we should move on to the next one. I think I'm right. Stephen Johnson. I'm a bit of a nerd, and over the years, I've grown more and more fascinated with the way that fictional worlds deal with politics, that is, the Republic and Star Wars. Of particular noteworthiness are certain episodes out of the Clone Wars animated series, Federation and Star Trek, the Council of Elrond, or the political maneuverings of Denethor and Gondor and the Lord of the Rings, and so on. Do either of you have any favorite fictional worlds, a favorite political system, history, or monument in any of those worlds? What do you got, Ed?
So, in general, I would say that, I don't read a ton of fiction these days. I certainly did as a younger man. I just don't these days. I kind of take that to be a character flaw in some ways. Like, I feel like I would be a better person if I read more fiction, but I just don't. And so, you're probably going to have a lot more to say about this question than I do. I don't know that I particularly attend to like the way in which political machinations are portrayed in these books. You know, but the one thing that I thought about as I saw this question, and this is less a political thing and more a social thing. Lewis's Space Trilogy? Do you know Lewis's Space Trilogy?
That you don't like the Space Trilogy? Just goes on and on and on.
You know, the last book is really peculiar. And I certainly like the last book less than I like the first two. I mean, you know, I think the depiction of the fall in the second book is like kind of genius. But you know, one thing that's interesting about the first book. So the first book, so for those who don't know, the conceit of C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy is that there are life on, I don't know if it's all the other planets. Certainly, a lot of the other planets, intelligent life. But on those other planets, there hasn't been a fall. Unlike the planet Earth, there never was a fall. And for complex reasons, the protagonist of the book ends up on Mars, which is one of these unfallen worlds. And there are three races of people on Mars. I can't remember their names, but they're all just kind of different. So one species on Mars is they're very academic, very academically oriented. One is sort of all into making things, and they're very practical. And the third group,
farmers of some kind.
Yeah, and they're more sentimental.
Poets, right?
More empathetic. They're sort of the one that Ransom identifies with the most, I think, and kind of the most sympathetic, just because they're sort of the most they have really high EQs, I guess you could say. And so all three species, they get along fine. It's an unfallen world. They're all friends. But there's a way in which, like, they don't get the other groups, and they're sort of like, you know, we like those academic-y type people, but gosh, you know, aren't they weird? They're always studying the stars, and I thought that was sort of a really kind of a cool depiction of like the way in which our differences really are complementary in important, useful ways. And I just always liked that picture of kind of like, I just don't get them. I like them and we're friends, but there's just a way in which I don't get them. And I found that to be like just like a nice depiction of the way in which our we're different and complementary in that way, and that's good, though it can generate sort of like a little bit of confusion sometimes. Well, but how about you, Coyle, on the general question of the depiction of politics?
Yeah, so I would
fiction?
Say in terms of which one do I like best, I honestly probably lean a little more in the Harry Potter direction than any of the ones he listed.
Those I have read, yeah.
Lord of the Rings, of course, is fantastic. C.S. Lewis, I've always been a little underwhelmed by his...
Do you like the Lord of the Ring movies?
You know, I do, so long as we're excluding the Hobbit movies.
I haven't seen that one, or those three, I guess.
The first of them was okay, and they got progressively worse. But the original trilogy, I do probably like Fellowship of the Ring more than the Two Towers or the Return of the King. So that's sort of my preference. I do like Star Trek. I'm actually subjecting my wife to it now. She did not watch it growing up, so we're watching through it.
Man, your wife is a good woman if she's watching Star Trek.
Well, I don't have permission to share what I'm watching with her, but it goes both ways. In terms of politically, probably Star Trek of all of these, Star Trek is the one that's the most democratic. Like if you or I were picked up in right now and dropped into one of these worlds, I mean, we'd be orc bait in Lord of the Rings. We would in the Star Wars world. I mean, if you don't have the midichlorians or whatever, you're basically worthless and you're going to die. But in Star Trek, like that's sort of the world that anyone could make their way in. I mean, yeah, the technology is advanced and everything, but at least the way it's portrayed in the movies, it's sort of accessible across the board, or at least the way it's portrayed in the TV shows. Like it is a place for normal people, where normal people do everything. I'd come down on the Star Trek side of things.
Great. Okay, so Charles Hackney of the Book of Nature podcast, another great podcast in the Christian Human Radio Network. He is one of the regulars on that show, and he's also an associate professor of psychology at Briarcrest College in Saskatchewan. Charles Hackney writes, "Greetings from Saskatchewan and from the Book of Nature podcast." And then he asks, "I'd like to hear your thoughts on Christian democracy. I just finished reading the special issue of Perspectives on Political Science on Christian Democracy. As a never hashtag never Trump conservative, I spent a big chunk of 2016 trying to see if there was anyone out there I could vote for, and I came across some people saying good things about the American Solidarity Party. If you wanted to do an entire episode on Christian democracy, I'd love it. But if you don't want to go that big, I'd appreciate it if you could take a few minutes in your AMA episode to give us a Christian democracy reading list so I can try to wrap my mind around this approach. I'm especially lost when it comes to trying to understand their distributist economics." So good news, Charles Hackney. Such an episode already exists. Well, kind of. So you might go back into the audio vaults and see the interview that Coyle did, and you did this by yourself, with Michael Matarin, who was the vice presidential?
He was the presidential.
The presidential, okay. Candidate for the American Solidarity Party. And Coyle did a nice interview with him. But Coyle, do you want to chip in on this and say something general about Christian democracy?
Not particularly. So at least the American Solidarity Party is sort of fairly standard Catholic social thought. Mm-hmm. So kind of a mix of, in an American context, what we call, you know, conservative and liberal, sort of liberal economic policies, conservative social policies.
Mm-hmm.
With the exception of death penalty, they're anti-death penalty again, because mm-hmm. kind of the Catholic direction. I assume Charles is talking about Christian democracy, like in the European political party sense, which is basically what the American Solidarity Party is trying to do. And I know almost nothing about modern European politics.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Charles, I have no answer to give you other than go and listen to the thing, and I will maybe I'll ask one of my colleagues here about book recommendations, and we'll throw them up on the blog.
Christian democracy is a kind of a fusionist political ideology that's like really informed by, so it's kind of conservative and it's also informed by Catholic social teaching as well as some like neo-Calvinist thinkers.
Right.
And it just hasn't really developed as a political movement in the United States. Though, I have to say that like insofar as I bump into that at all, like I also like Charles, sort of find it confusing. And part of it is for me, it's just sort of like, you know, both Catholic social thought, you know, it sort of arises out of like that very specific kind of Catholic Thomist metaphysic, you know? And so it's sort of it's sometimes rooted in like very particular philosophical or theological foundations. And then certainly like you could say the exact same thing about like neo-Calvinism. It's sort of rooted in like this very particular kind of funky kind of like metaphysical system, and there's just a way in which whenever I approach it, it's sort of like, so I'm always sort of like, huh?
We'll get to this in a minute, but I am a fan of Abraham Kuyper. So if you're looking for sort of the one name that I know, Abraham Kuyper is the guy to pick up and read. But even then, his politics, in the immediately practical sense of the political party that he was part of the founding of, and that he became prime minister of the Netherlands as a part of, that's sort of the part where I agree with him least. His political philosophy, that's different. I think there's a lot that's compelling there, but like his practical day-to-day politics, which is kind of the Protestant side of that Christian democracy stuff, from what I understand.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I'm kind of like, there's some church-state stuff going on there that maybe needs a little more hashing out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, like I, at one time in my life, was sort of very influenced by that kind of Kuyperian politics. But, like that's sort of like the paradigmatic example of, like, this crazy metaphysic. And I'm just like all that sphere sovereignty talk, I just sort of think is kind of hard to make sense of. But
and yet
anyways.
You like Rawls.
Oh, I mean, Rawls. It's a clear system. It has very clear foundations, and you work out from it. I mean, it's complicated, but it's very orderly. And the foundations aren't particularly controversial, so, anyways. But I think we've done an episode about that.
Yeah, we've done several episodes on that.
We've done a couple.
At some point, we should do a readings episode on Rawls and just pick something of his and work through it down the road. And a question coming in from Danny Anderson. I'm not entirely sure who he is or what he does for a living.
I've heard that name before.
Yeah. In the
wasn't he like a serial killer that they found in
Ohio? I wouldn't want to guess about that too much. Danny Anderson from the Sectarian Review, who has been on this show and who does in some ways a much more eclectic podcast than anyone else on the network, maybe excluding the flagship show. Danny asks, could you guys talk in some more detail about copyright law? My belief is that it has been manipulated and abused by corporate interests, which have unduly influenced the expansion of copyright law and has actually become an inhibitor to innovation and creativity. Love to hear your thoughts. And my thought is, Danny, just buy the CD. All right? I mean, come on. Ed, what do you got?
This is like Danny's genius is sort of like the particularities and eccentricities of his thought. Like, that's kind of what makes his show so interesting and great. And so he gives us this totally random eccentric question. And I kind of feel like, I mean, come on, Danny. Like, so this is what's going on. Like, Danny's being sued in some way for copyright infringement. And he's like trying to outsource his legal research to us. Kind of like when you go and you meet a doctor at a party and you're like, oh, you know, there's this weird rash that's broken out on my fill in the blank body part. You know, could you take a look at it?
I have no other explanation for this.
Danny, figure your rash out yourself. We're not your doctors. No, I do you have anything to say about copyright law? Every time the Mickey Mouse copyright is set to expire, right? They kick the can down the road for like 25, like, well, literally.
They renew the copyright. I mean, Disney.
No. But the law that gives you copyright protection, right? The period is like 100 years or something like that.
I don't remember off the top.
And
of my head.
I
think it's different for print versus.
Yeah, that's right. But there was a point in which the original Mickey Mouse, like Steamboat Willie, is that what the first? Like every time within, like it was due to go out of copyright in sometime in the last, I'm going to just sort of say 10 to 15 years, and like right when it got up to that, they extended the amount of copyright protection that you get. This is kind of interesting to me as an academic issue insofar as it sort of touches on the nature of property rights.
Right.
And in this instance, I mean, so, you know, I think all property rights are constructed, and in some ways I like examples like this because it's really obviously the case in a case. It just sort of shows how claims over ideas are constructed. So I kind of like examples like this. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, this is one of those instances, I think, in which whatever like the really smart law and economics people tell us about like what maximizes creative efficiencies in this area, that should just be the answer. And
I suspect there's this is one of those cases where there's no way to have the law do what you want it to do, which of course is protect the little author, right? The guy who's just written his first novel and takes to get it published and doesn't want, you know, the big publishing corporation mm-hmm. to steal it from him and not give him any money. So we want the laws to protect them, but there is no way to write the law to protect those folks in a way that doesn't also protect, you know, the evil corporations that Danny's talking about. Like it's you protect everyone or you protect no one, and that means that even the people we don't like get protected too. I paid a lot more attention to this issue back in the late 90s, early 2000s when you know, online piracy was a bigger thing.
Mm-hmm.
so copyright in terms of downloading music and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And back
were you
then,
a Napster? Were you a Napster guy?
No, I was. I was definitely on the side of the uh-huh. recording artist, recording uh-huh. industry at that point. And even with the, you know, yes, they're making all these, you know, millions of dollars and so on. And is it really that damaging to steal, you know, to steal the music online? Maybe, maybe not. It's obviously stealing music. I mean, that's sort of the user does not have creative control over the object that he's using. Anyway, that's I haven't really paid attention to it since then, since, you know, early 2000s. So I don't know that I have anything exciting to say about the modern law.
Yeah. So, anyways, Danny, just hire a lawyer. Our next question is from the famous mathematician Mark Bates, who writes, "As a Christian, how do you balance the dual messages of helping the poor and otherwise marginalized and personal responsibility, which is often the hallmark of the Judeo-Christian work ethic?" Mr. Neal, you want to offer your thoughts on this question?
Well, obviously you should do both. You should work hard and you should help the poor. I don't know that that has to be a balancing act.
I think the balancing act is like the accusation that the poor haven't been responsible. And so...
Right. Right. So how do we encourage others to do the same thing? Mm-hmm. Right. Because we don't just encourage other people to work hard. We also encourage them to be charitable. So both are things that we should do ourselves. Both are things that we should be encouraging other people to do. I know what he's asking, and I'm just going to hesitate to give a rock solid answer to that, because again, I think it is possible in our own lives to do that practically. Now, if we'll have a healthcare episode coming out, probably more than one. I suspect we'll have to do another one, where we talk a little bit about, you know, personal responsibility as opposed to our obligation to take care of each other. And in the sort of public and social sense, there is something of a balancing act. You know, do you provide healthcare? If we're providing, you know, single payer socialized healthcare for everyone, does that mean we also provide it for the smoker? Or are we? Do we have some kind of obligation as a society now to tell that person you don't get to smoke anymore? Or if you do smoke, you lose your socialized healthcare? Again, those are all big questions that come along. That sort of big picture thinking, you rarely have to decide in your own life. There will be occasions when you have to decide, you know, will I be charitable to this person? Particularly people who live in the city, cities with lots of homeless people, right? That's a question you engage all the time. Do I give this person who's asking for money or not? And I think as a Christian, I'm perfectly willing to say it's never wrong to be charitable. It's never wrong to give, even if you don't know what they're going to do with the money, even if you think they're going to go out and, you know, use it on drugs or what have you. Maybe it's better to give food. That was sort of always what I tried to do, was if I had food with me, I would give that away instead. What do you think, Ed?
Yeah, the question kind of struck a chord with me, so I am going to sort of stake out a big splashy answer. Part of it is, we were talking about this in class the other day, and I mean, I would say that, like, your average American evangelical Christian sees the biblical teachings on helping the most disadvantaged as being, like, you know, like a part of the package of Christian moral and theological teaching. But I think they sort of see that as being, you might disagree with me on this, but like a secondary kind of a part of the package. And like, when you look at Scripture, the fiercest denunciations that you find in the Old Testament, you know, the fiercest denunciation that God is articulating through his prophets, are because the rulers of Israel have failed to take care of the need of the orphan, the stranger, the poor, and the resident alien. Nick Walterstorff, in his big book on justice, calls them the quartet of the vulnerable. And there are, like, the frequency and vociferousness of those moral pronouncements is kind of overwhelming in the Old Testament. And then again, you look at the New Testament and you see the way in which Jesus practiced his ministry, right? And he practiced his ministry by announcing the king, you know, the way in which he demonstrated that the kingdom of God had come to earth was by spending time again with the outcast, the poor, the crippled, the lame. It's not like that's a secondary part to the Christian life. Like, I would say, this is going to sound a little bit more social justice-y than I mean it to be, and I don't mean it to sort of sound that way at all. But, like, N.T. Wright has this nice phrase that, like, God is bringing the world to rights. God created this beautiful, perfect world in which we could dwell with each other and dwell with God, and then it broke. And God slowly, first by finding one righteous man, Abraham, who begot a nation, who begot a savior, who gave birth to a church, like, God is bringing the world to rights. I would say that, like, that is just what it is to be a Christian. It's sort of to follow and announce the fact that Jesus is Lord by extending the justice of God and being his agents of redemptive change in the world. And then on the responsibility front, I'm all into personal responsibility. But there's a way in which I think that language in the 20th century America sort of imports, like, all of these overtones and that have to do with the unique cultural heritage we have in the United States, in which you could make it here if you were able to, because there was basically a unlimited supply of land and resources. And so you could always make it if you went a little bit further west and were willing to sort of work hard and square out your farm. And that sort of led to the valorization of these very sort of particularly individualistic picture of going out into nature and through one's own hard work and wit and daring, making your way in the world. And again, like, I think personal responsibility is, like, a really, really great and important thing. But there's just a way in which, like, what that means in the 21st century United States sort of imports these additional kinds of elements that I think are kind of problematic. So, like, I prefer talking about, like, the more ancient, like, the ancient Greek virtue of temperance, which I think is sort of, you know, doesn't have the same kind of cultural overtones attached to it.
Well, it's also certainly lacking in our culture, right? I mean,
temperance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Self-control thing is pretty much non-existent. So maybe it's tied to personal responsibility and work ethic and so on.
Yeah. You know, I believe in personal responsibility, but I like that language is kind of problematic to me and kind of bordering on a kind of idolatry, actually.
Right. And I would hesitate to make either of those, either generosity to the poor or personal responsibility, superior to the other. I mean, Christians should exhibit both of those things, and we should encourage others to do so as well. But yeah, we basically have that conversation every time we talk about, you know, welfare or healthcare or what have you.
Yes, maybe that will be coming out in another 2 weeks, maybe.
Right. So am I up next, or are you? I've lost my
voice. You are up next.
All right, Jim Loring writes, particularly enjoy your book review discussions on your Christian Humanist podcasts. I will assume he means City of Man, and that this is not supposed to be an email to the Christian Humanists.
He's emailing the wrong show.
You know,
he hates our show, and he.
Oh. Well, then he does ask, interesting to hear a review or recommendation of the top 10 or so political books every literate Christian should read, or some such, ancient and modern.
Means like our discussion of Hillbilly Elegy is what he means.
Right. No. That's certainly true. And then we've done some articles here and there, too.
Yeah.
So what do you got, Ed? Maybe each of us should do 5 of these?
Yeah, so I kind of put together a pretty eccentric list. So there are some sort of obvious things in the canon, like, do you say Augustine or do you say Augustine?
Either one's fine. I'm fine with either.
Anyways.
I tend to say Augustine, but
I don't know what I say. I think I say Augustine as well. So, I mean, like, you know, if you're putting together the canon, you know,
City of God.
Hey, somebody should make a podcast called The City of Man. Wouldn't that be a good idea?
They should.
A friend of mine who's a political theorist was sort of like, criticizing our title, because basically what a City of Man podcast would really be about would be like about paganism. Right. But anyways, which I kind of like actually in some ways, but everybody I think should sort of be familiar with like those kinds of works in the canon. But to be honest, like if I were busy with work and family and all of that stuff, I don't know that like picking up the City of God and just reading it on my own would necessarily be like the best use of my time. And so I sort of put together a slightly eccentric list of books that have just sort of been particularly important for me for sometimes some eccentric reasons. Some of these books are books that we've probably mentioned in passing in some of our other shows. You know, one very academic book that, again, I wouldn't necessarily recommend that people just go and pick up, but sort of the one very academic book on my list is Nicholas Wolterstorff's Justice, Right and Wrongs, which I think is a sort of a really compelling account of the Christian theological roots of the idea of rights and its centrality for thinking about justice. It's a book I'm actually teaching even as we speak. Well, not literally as we speak, I guess, but we're covering that book right now. Nick's kind of a beloved person to me, and that's just a book that I like a lot and I think is super interesting. Though, again, very academic, and I don't know that I would just sort of tell somebody to go off and read that book unless they were sort of really up for a kind of a dense challenge. Another book, well, this is a bit of a two-parter, but N.T. Wright, Tom Wright's book, Jesus and the Victory of God and or The Challenge of Jesus, are really, really amazing books. And, like, the amazing thing about N.T. Wright is that, like, you know, he has these scholarly works that he spins out. And then he does this really cool thing where he'll, like, articulate versions of those books for, like, more popular audiences. So Jesus and the Victory of God is this mammoth tome on the study of the historical Jesus that is just an extraordinary book. And then what he did was he sort of wrote – so that's a very scholarly academic book. And then he wrote another book that I would sort of say is like the grad student version of that book that makes a lot of those insights a little bit – I mean, it's still smart but more accessible. And that book is called The Challenge of Jesus. And then kind of the cool thing about The Challenge of Jesus is that he sort of takes this scholarly study of the Gospels and of the historical Jesus and kind of also makes it more accessible, and then kind of tacks on a couple chapters at the end that are like a little bit more practical. And those two books, maybe especially together, but I guess in some ways if I had to choose one, I'd actually choose that second book, The Challenge of Jesus. That's the best book I've ever read. Like the most, I read that in the time of my life after I graduated college and was, had become a Christian, but also was trying to figure out like what it meant to be a Christian in like the real world. And in some ways sort of found like the theological tools that I graduated college with to be a little bit lacking. That book was really, really super formative for me. And just sort of laying out, this is a it's political in only a kind of a secondary way, but sort of really laying out what I took to be a compelling picture of the vocation of what it is to be a Christian. Richard Hayes's book, The Moral Vision of the New Testament, I mentioned earlier and in earlier episodes, that is more a moral theology than political theology. But again, in kind of a scholarly book, a really great book. Charles Taylor, The Secular Age, is another mammoth tome dedicated to understanding modernity. I think it's like a really super interesting, important book. And a little bit more recently, again, none of these books are really sort of particularly political. And I haven't even finished reading this book, but Arlie Hochschild's Strangers in Their Own Land is right, so that is her study of the white working class. She did a pretty detailed ethnographic study in southwestern Louisiana. That book strikes a chord with us just because, you know, we lived in Louisiana for 7 years, and so we sort of identify with the culture of that place and the particular kinds of struggles and pathologies that people go through. But it's this really, really sympathetic. I mean, Hochschild is a liberal but it's this really sympathetic portrayal of the white working class and their perspective on the world. And like, I just think Hochschild is like the greatest public intellectual. Like, her books are always just uniquely interesting, and she has her finger on like the issues that really, really matter. So she's just somebody who I really admire as a scholar. I'll shut up now. How about, I think that was five books, maybe that was even six, but how about you, Coyle?
Yeah, so that, you know, which book should I read is, man, that's a question you could just go on and on and on about, right? Particularly since the way he phrased it, we could take it either as, you know, books about sort of Christian views on politics or just books that Christians should read. So we could say, you know, Plato's Republic, and it's obviously not a Christian book, but a literate Christian should have read that. So I would say just a few random ones, and these are not necessarily in any particular order. I would, by the way, agree with you about City of God, Augustine, City of God, Augustine, City of God, whichever way you want to take that. Can be overwhelming, particularly the first six or seven books can be kind of a bear to get through because they're all about, you know, disproving paganism, and I don't know many modern Americans who need to hear about why Zeus isn't really a god. The Confessions is a better place to start if you're just getting into Augustine. It's shorter, easier to read. There's more of a narrative. And how you do with this is the last three books of the Confessions are where he gets sort of metaphysical and abstract and starts talking about his personal life. If you read those and think this was really engaging, I want to read more, then go pick up City of God. If you read those and think the first nine books were great and these last three books were just awful, that's fine. Set it aside and leave it there. I've appreciated Abraham Kuyper's writing, and again, our last question, we'll get into that a little bit. His most famous political work is a series called Lectures on Calvinism, and honestly, the political chapter in that is the weakest chapter. It's the one that I sort of least recommend. His works are in the process of being translated, and the book of his to pick up that's come out more recently is a book called Our Program. That's where he sort of lays out his political philosophy in more detail and the sorts of practical things they want to do in the Netherlands. As I said earlier in the episode, there are bits of that I disagree with when he's talking about, you know, party politics and so on. But by and large, the stuff he has to say about education, the stuff he has to say about social policy and so on, I think those are worth reading. I mentioned in some of the episodes I've done with Jordan Poss, Charles Norris Cochran's Christianity and Classical Culture, just a great book to read. It's a hard one. It takes time to sort of stomp through, but it is worth doing that. It's worth the dedication it takes to get through it is definitely rewarding. And then something more modern, Natural Law and the Two Kingdoms by David Van Drunen. I think like N.T. Wright, there is a sort of a more popular version of that, but I don't remember what it's called. So Natural Law and the Two Kingdoms is kind of a more modern way of looking at the state. I would also say a Christian should read something that explains the modern world politically, and I don't have a book in mind. I don't have something that I would say go pick this up and read it. There's a 60s reader called The Times They Are a Changin'. That's sort of a good intro to where we're at now, since the people who've shaped where we're at now were all coming of age in the 60s. So it goes through the new left and the new right, and articulates the foundations of basically what we're living in now. And if that's not five, I would also say there needs to be some fiction in there to get us back to...
good. Give us a good fiction book.
You know, that's going to depend on what kind of fiction you want to read. So Lord of the Rings, of course, I mean, it's hard to top that as Christian fiction. If any of the Christian humanists were here, they would say The Brothers Karamazov is what ought to be read. I found that to be kind of long, but again...
Really?
It is long, and it at times felt long.
I had a very aged, it's kind of important phenomenologist when I was in college, and he was very aged and very sort of mysterious. I always describe him as like, imagine Santa Claus, but now imagine like Santa Claus's evil brother. And that's kind of what...
Krampus.
Maurice Natanson, who was this philosophy professor at Yale in the 90s. And he always said that The Brothers K was a book that you had to read before you graduated from college. And
yeah, I took a Soviet literature class with a gentleman who was from the Soviet Union who'd come here as an Olympic boxer and then defected.
So not Russian literature, but Soviet literature.
Yes, it was 20th century literature.
Yeah.
It was great. Like I really enjoyed a lot of that stuff.
Uh-huh.
But it did not include The Brothers K. I didn't read that until grad school. I tend to gravitate towards science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So my general advice is if you are ever only going to read one work of science fiction, if you just you know your sort of your personality, the only thing you'll ever read is just one, then you should read Dune. Dune is hands down the greatest work of science fiction. It's the one that makes even the hoity-toity English professor lists of great literature. They usually don't put science fiction on it, but Dune does make that list, those sorts of lists.
I think I saw the movie in the 80s.
Yeah,
Sting was in it.
We don't speak of that movie. the Sci-Fi Channel miniseries was slightly better, but only slightly. If you think you might read more than that, I would say start with Ender's Game or Starship Troopers. Both of those.
Yeah, my daughter recently. Wait, is that right? Actually, well, maybe that's no. I take that back. She hasn't read that.
Which one?
I'm getting her confused with something else. Ender's Game, but that's not right at all, actually.
I don't know. Sorry. I don't know what your daughter read. It might be. It is technically young adult fiction.
If you knew what my daughter read, you and I would have to have words, because that would be a little bit weird, Coyle.
It would be. There aren't a lot of Christian science fiction writers of note, but probably the one that comes closest is a guy named Cordwainer Smith. And he wrote primarily short stories, so you can get them all in one volume. He was one of the founders of the CIA and the godchild of Sun Yat-sen. So a very interesting guy sort of across the board. Yeah. He literally wrote the book on psychological warfare. He was one of the major advisors in the early days of Vietnam until he sort of washed his hands of it in disgust. Cordwainer Smith obviously was not his real name, but he writes science fiction that is sort of heavily Christian themed. Although whether or not he was a Christian is sort of up in the air. People don't know because again he was with the CIA and a lot of that stuff was kept under wraps. All right, that's probably enough book recommendations. What do we got?
And so we go to our last question from Mark Anthony Tara Thomas, who writes, "Gentlemen, greetings. First, I love the podcast. It usually has me yelling at my iPhone, which makes for much comedy at the gym. I wonder if he's yelling at you or if he's yelling at me. In any case, I was wondering if you two could address natural law. From your perspective, does it exist? If not, what standard do we use when judging human actions? If it does, how do your two political perspectives square with natural law?" Mr. Neal?
Yeah, so that's a tough one. That's obviously a Romans 1 question, right? There are standards and rules and ethical norms that are established by God, that are reflective of God's character, that exist in the world, that all human beings have access to. I think that's fairly clear from Romans 1. But Romans 1 also says that everybody rejects them. So they're out there, but we close our eyes and turn the other direction. So if that's what he means by natural law, then yeah, I'm fine with it. Where I think that gets a little bit problematic is when you start asking questions like he goes on to ask in his follow-up question, how do you turn that into actual codified law? How do you discover the natural law? How do you get access to it and then translate it into legislative statute? That I think is more problematic, and as a Christian, I'm always going to be a little bit hesitant about that. I'm not a scholar of the natural law tradition, and I don't think you are either, Ed. But correct me if I'm wrong.
No, I'm a skeptic actually, but we'll get to that in a second.
Yeah. So from what I understand, there are kind of the two streams of natural law thought. Right. There's the natural law that runs through Thomas Aquinas, and kind of moves into the modern world through Catholic social thought, and then there's the natural law stream that's kind of the theologically liberal Protestant view that runs through Hegel and moves into the modern world and contemporary theologically liberal social thought. where, you know, we have sort of progress moving on and things are moving forward and getting better, and that's reflected in the world as well. I would want to push back against both of those streams, albeit for different reasons. I would say that rather than natural law, a better sort of category to use is the category of common grace. And again, I would point to Abraham Kuyper, his sphere sovereignties that you were talking about earlier. I think is just a better way to think about it. That way we can talk about moral truths. We can talk about why good things happen in the world. We can talk about why bad things happen in the world without having to find some way to turn all of those conclusions into legislation. Without having to try to find sort of universal rules that are applicable to everyone, regardless. And I know there's more nuance in the natural law tradition than that, but I think sort of the more kind of Lutheran / Reformed tradition of political thought is much more useful than that natural law tradition. Ed, what do you think there?
To me, Kuyper and like all of that sphere sovereignty, neo-Calvinist sphere sovereignty stuff, I sort of think of that as actually being natural law for Protestants.
It's close, right? You certainly have natural law for Protestants. Again, on the theologically liberal side of things, where you have just sort of the open, things are getting better, we're moving forward, natural law is unfolding along with revelation over time. So the Schleiermachers and so on. So I think that's probably more entrenched in a natural law kind of worldview. Kuyper and the Kuyperians can lean in that direction, but it's not quite the same thing, particularly since they explicitly reject natural law. They come right out and say, yeah, that's not what we mean by it.
Yeah. To me, it's kind of all the same thing. I mean, so I would just say, so the aforementioned Brian McGraw at Wheaton, for example, is, I think, among his interests is trying to like revive natural law thought for evangelicals thinking about politics. My own Westmont colleague, Jesse Covington, is sort of also in on that business with him. But, so one thing that I would say is that to talk about natural law is natural law is not just a synonym for moral objectivity or moral realism, right?
Sure.
It's not natural law isn't just the view that there are moral truths out there. Like, so I think that there are moral truths out there. For my part, I would just say that the particular kind of story that natural law theorists give about the origins of those truths isn't particularly persuasive to me. But then there are other kinds of stories that you can tell to try to generate what exactly the nature of those moral commitments are. But I've always sort of found that all that stuff problematic for reasons that probably aren't worth going into. But we should probably talk about natural law at some point and sort of spend some time, an episode, hammering through that.
Yeah, I would find that easier if we were to pick like a thinker or a text and do it that way, just because it's such a large tradition.
Maybe we should invite the aforementioned Brian McGraw on as a guest.
I think that would be fun.
Pay him homage since he was the person who brought us together, Coyle.
Yeah, I would be absolutely fine with that.
Anyways.
His follow-up question we should...
Oh yeah, what was the follow-up?
What do you both think of the notion from Cicero that a legislature does not exist to create a law? Legislature exists to ratify what has been discovered or rediscovered in the ratification process.
You want to speak to the Cicero question?
Yeah, again, well, I don't know if that's from Cicero or not. It sounds Ciceronian. Yeah, again, I would hesitate on that. I understand why people think that. I understand why people want to hold that. I think it's probably giving legislators way too much credit. And B, I think I may just have a more robust view of both original sin and common grace than is required to be a natural law thinker. I think you have to sort of tone both of those things down a little bit in order to end up in that camp. And I can't go there.
Okay, I was going to ask you this sort of big, deep, probing question about the foundations of your conservatism, and get my own ask you anything question.
And I was going to ask you what your social security number is and your mother's maiden name. So,
sure, it's 323. No, I'm joking. But how about this? Why don't we close with a lightning round? Awesome. I have 10 either-or questions. You have to choose one or the other. I will play the game as well. Okay? And
although, to
these
be fair,
be
you came up with the questions. So
I did. Some of these questions might not even make sense to you, but that's kind of interesting. Some of them are sort of like evangelical cultural questions. I didn't grow up in the church, and so I learn all this stuff secondhand, and so I don't know. And you're also younger than me. But anyways, here we go. You ready?
Sure.
Boxers or briefs?
Is that an appropriate question?
This is not the kind of question you should hesitate over, Cole. You either know or you don't know.
I'm hesitating over whether I want that publicly known. I know what the answer is.
I have a guess.
It's briefs. How about you, Ed?
That would have been my guess. I'm boxers. I remember very vividly when boxers became cool when I was in like sixth grade. And soccer players would wear them and you could kind of see them hanging out from under their shorts. And that was the point at which I switched over to boxers. All right,
yeah,
second question.
We may not want a question about our underwear on the air, but yeah.
Well done or medium rare?
Well done.
Ah, you are like such the stereotypical. You're just a caricature of the conservative.
Because I like my food dead?
Because you're a brief wearing, well done eaten. medium rare for me.
You're the urban hippie now.
I don't have
probably
any tattoos.
Wine and, while you're eating it.
Not so much actually.
Music playing in the background. No sawdust on the floor whatsoever.
This is a question that's a little bit more of a Santa Barbara question, but anyways, beaches or mountains?
Mountains.
I think I would go beaches, but that's like 60-40 for me. Okay, how about this one? Organ or guitar? And I obviously mean, yeah. So is your church, is it all traditional in hymns?
So I am not going to talk about my present church because we just joined.
You and I had talked about that recently.
Yeah, so I've been a member at churches that use, so I've sort of done the whole spectrum. So I've been a member at a church that uses praise band and does sort of contemporary music. The church I went to college when I was an undergrad, that was the church I went to college in. The church I was at in D.C., it is not hymns only, but it is congregational singing. So piano, guitar, few people leading the music, and then kind of a mostly hymns, but with some modern music thrown in, sort of carefully selected music that can be sung by, 800 non-experts. So my disposition is increasingly towards not using a praise band. Maybe that's probably the best way to say that. I'm not smothering the congregation, but rather letting the congregation sing, which is a challenge because nobody really knows how to sing anymore. That's something that's dying. How about you, Ed? Organ or guitar?
So I play in my church's praise band. So I guess I would say guitar. But I prefer blended worship.
Sure.
And I am like hugely critical of the way that like a lot of contemporary praise. I mean, like we listen to contemporary praise music. I play contemporary praise music at church. I also like there's a lot of thing about that. A lot of stuff about that culture that I don't like. But
well, so little of it is written to be sung by a group of people, right? I mean, it's written to be performed on the radio or I guess on YouTube now. It's rarely written to be sung by a group of people who are not musically trained, who are singing once a week.
Yeah. I think a lot of it really is for the radio, but anyways. So my next question was going to be Hillsong or Bethel, but maybe that's moot for you.
Yeah, I don't know the difference between those two, so that's fine.
I would say Hillsong for those of you keeping score at home. How about this one? Coke or Pepsi?
Coke.
Ah, see, I'm like we haven't agreed yet, have we?
You pick guitar solely because you play it. That doesn't mean that's what you prefer.
Well, no. I mean, I think I would have picked guitar anyway. I'm gonna go with Pepsi.
Okay.
And like, I really do think that Pepsi is objectively better, and that people only say Coke out of like force of habit. But like, Pepsi's sweeter, it tastes better. To me, a cherry Pepsi is like the greatest drink in the world.
Okay. I actually don't do a whole lot of pop anymore or soda. I'm not sure if I'm in pop country or soda country, but it's coffee. Coffee is the answer, Ed.
I was going to ask you, coffee or tea was all there was a version of that on another list. Coffee or tea?
Coffee.
Black or with cream?
Depends on the time of day.
Good. I'm with you on that.
All right.
So we agree on something. Fiction or nonfiction?
Fiction.
I'm going to go nonfiction. Scrambled or sunny side?
Scrambled.
I'm going to go sunny side.
So your answer is the second answer for all of these?
No, maybe I did that subconsciously, but I didn't.
That's kind of the well-done medium rare question, though, too, right? I mean, scrambled or sunny side.
I guess that's right. I guess that's the breakfast version of that question.
Right.
How about this? Michael W. Smith or Stephen Curtis Chapman?
I know both of those names. I don't know that I could tell you any differences. Is one of them? They're both singers, right? It's not like one of them is a singer and one's an author.
No, they're both Christian.
Yeah, I can't answer that.
CCM. Yeah, I barely can either, but I guess I would go with Stephen Curtis Chapman. I said NIV or NRSV. I guess we've already covered it. You ready? So we'll skip that one. You ready for the last one? This is a big one. You ready? Now I'm going to give you three choices. Nathan, Michael, or David? You can only choose one.
Oh, man, there's got to be setting for that, though, in context.
No, it's better not to think about it and just to blurt out an answer, I think.
Oh, man. You know what? I am going to go with Nathan. Because I think I probably yell at him more when I'm listening.
Have you met him?
I've not met him in person.
Okay.
I hope not. Nathan, if I have, I'm sorry. I've forgotten.
I
think I've only met Michael. No, I've only met
David.
So
this is easy for me. Okay. Wait, sorry, you have met David or you haven't met David?
I have met David. I've not met the other two in person.
So this is easy for me because I've only met Nathan. Nathan's the only one that I've met, and he's a mensch. So I'm going to go with Nathan. Apologies to Michael or David. This isn't a judgment on your character. I just haven't shaken your hand and looked you in the eye.
No, I'm judging your character. That's...
In any case, you have wasted another perfectly good hour, or maybe 90 minutes, listening to us yammer on as we celebrate the one-year anniversary of this show, the City of Man podcast. As always, we are proud and happy members of the Christian Humanist Radio Network, but maybe as of today, a little bit less so, depending on how Michael and David feel about us. Our press liaison there is Kristen Filippik. We really do appreciate all the feedback that we get from you all. It's really helpful and rewarding for us. Please do leave a review on iTunes for us, or you can touch base with us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast. You can shoot us an email at our email account, which is just cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. Again, we're very, very grateful to all of our listeners, all the people who have gotten something out of the show. It's very gratifying to know that people out there are listening, and it's been an extremely rewarding experience in this first year for both Coil and myself, and we are both very much looking forward to our second year with you all. And so, as always, I will close us out by reminding everyone to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar, and to render
this
unto God those things
land,
that are God's.
And
thanks
land
so
is
much.
My land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.